Random House Audio presents A Red Herring Without Mustard, A Flavia Deluce Mystery by Alan Bradley, read for you by Jane Entwistle. A cup of ale without a wench, why, alas, 'tis like an egg without salt or a red herring without mustard. Thomas Lodge and Robert Greene, A Looking Glass for London and England, 1592. Chapter 1.
"You frighten me," the gypsy said. "Never have I seen my crystal ball so filled with darkness."
She cupped her hands around the thing, as if to shield my eyes from the horrors that were swimming in its murky depths. As her fingers gripped the glass, I thought I could feel ice water trickling down inside my gullet. At the edge of the table, a thin candle flickered, its sickly light glancing off the dangling brass hoops of the gypsy's earrings, then flying off to die somewhere in the darkened corners of the tent. Black hair, black eyes, black dress, red painted cheeks, red mouth, and a voice that could only have come from smoking 500,000 cigarettes. As if to confirm my suspicions, the old woman was suddenly gripped by a fit of violent coughing that rattled her crooked frame and left her gasping horribly for air. It sounded as though a large bird had somehow become entangled in her lungs and was flapping to escape.
"Are you all right?" I asked. "I'll go for help."
I thought I had seen Dr. Darby in the churchyard not 10 minutes earlier, pausing to have a word or two at each stall of the church fete. But before I could make a move, the gypsy's dusky hand had covered mine on the black velvet of the tabletop.
"No," she said. "No, don't do that. It happens all the time."
And she began to cough again. I waited it out patiently, almost afraid to move.
"How old are you?" she said at last. 10? 12?
11,
I said. And she nodded her head wearily, as though she'd known it all along.
"I see a mountain," she went on, almost strangling on the words. "And the face of the woman you will become."
In spite of the stifling heat of the darkened tent, my blood ran cold. She was seeing Harriet, of course. Harriet was my mother, who had died in a climbing accident when I was a baby. The gypsy turned my hand over and dug her thumb painfully into the very center of my palm. My fingers spread and then curled in upon themselves like the toes of a chicken's severed foot. She took up my left hand.
"This is the hand you were born with," she said,
barely glancing at the palm, then letting it fall and picking up the other.
"And this is the hand you've grown."
She stared at it distastefully as the candle flickered.
"This broken star on your Mount of Luna shows a brilliant mind turned in upon itself, a mind that wanders the roads of darkness."
This was not what I wanted to hear. "Tell me about the woman you saw on the mountain," I said, "the one I shall become." She coughed again, clutching her coloured shawl tightly about her shoulders, as though wrapping herself against some ancient and invisible winter wind.
"Cross my palm with silver," she demanded, sticking out a grubby hand.
"But I gave you a shilling," I said. "That's what it says on the board outside."
"Messages from the third circle cost extra," she wheezed. "They drain the batteries of my soul."
I almost laughed out loud.
Who did this old hag think she was?
But still, she seemed to have spotted Harriet beyond the veil, and I couldn't let skepticism spoil even half a chance of having a few words with my dead mother. I dug for my last shilling, and as I pressed the coin into her hand, the gypsy's dark eyes, suddenly as bright as a jackdaw's, met mine.
"She is trying to come home," she said. "This woman is trying to come home from the cold. She wants you to help her.
I leapt to my feet, bashing the bottom of the table with my bare knees. It teetered, then toppled to one side as the candle slid off and fell among a tangle of dusty black hangings. At first there was a little wisp of black smoke as the flame turned blue, then red, then quickly orange. I looked on in horror as it spread along the drapery. In less time than it takes to tell, the entire tent was in flames. I wish I'd had the presence of mind to throw a wet cloth over the gypsy's eyes and lead her to safety. But instead I bolted, straight through the circle of fire that was the entranceway, and I didn't stop until I reached the coconut pitch, where I stood panting behind a canvas drape, trying to catch my breath. Someone had brought a wind-up gramophone to the churchyard, from which the voice of Danny Kaye was issuing, made nauseously tinny by the throat of the machine's painted horn. "Oh, I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts. There they are, a-standing in a row." I looked back at the gypsy's tent just in time to see Mr. Haskins, St. Tancred's sexton, and another man whom I didn't recognize, heave a tub of water, apples and all, onto the flames. Half the villagers of Bishop's Lacey, or so it seemed, stood gaping at the rising column of black smoke, hands over mouths or fingertips to cheeks, and not a single one of them knowing what to do. Dr. Darby was already leading the gypsy slowly away towards the St. John's ambulance tent, her ancient frame racked with coughing. How small she seemed in the sunlight, I thought, and how pale.
"Oh, there you are, you odious little prawn. We've been looking for you everywhere."
It was Ophelia, the older of my two sisters. Feely was 17 and ranked herself right up there with the Blessed Virgin Mary, although the chief difference between them, I'm willing to bet, is that the BVM doesn't spend 23 hours a day peering at herself in a looking glass while picking away at her face with a pair of tweezers. With Feely, it was always best to employ the rapid retort.
"How dare you call me a prawn, you stupid sausage? Father's told you more than once it's disrespectful."
Feely made a snatch at my ear, but I sidestepped her easily. By sheer necessity, the lightning dodge had become one of my specialties.
"Where's Daffy?"
I asked, hoping to divert her venomous attention. Daffy was my other sister, 2 years older than me, and at 13, already an accomplished co-torturer.
"Drooling over the books. Where else?"
She pointed with her chin to a horseshoe of trestle tables on the churchyard grass, upon which the St. Tancred's Altar Guild and the Women's Institute had joined forces to set up a jumble sale of second-hand books and assorted household rubbish. Feely had seemed not to notice the smoking remnants of the gypsy's tent. As always, she had left her spectacles at home out of vanity, but her inattentiveness might simply have been lack of interest. For all practical purposes, Feely's enthusiasm stopped where her skin ended.
"Look at these," she said, holding a set of black earrings up to her ears. She couldn't resist showing off. "French jet. They came from Lady Trotter's estate. Glenda says they were quite fortunate to get a tanner for them."
"Glenda's right," I said. "French jet is nothing but glass." It was true. I had recently melted down a ghastly Victorian brooch in my chemical laboratory and found it to be completely silicaceous. It was unlikely that Feely would ever miss the thing.
"English jet is so much more interesting," I said. "It's formed from the fossilized remains of monkey puzzle trees, you see, and..."
But Feely was already walking away, lured by the sight of Ned Cropper, the ginger-haired potboy at the 13 Drakes, who, with a certain muscular grace, was energetically tossing wooden batons at the Aunt Sally. His third stick broke the wooden figure's clay pipe clean in two,
and Feely pulled up at his side just in time to be handed the teddy bear prize by the madly blushing Ned.
"Anything worth saving from the bonfire?" I asked Daffy, who had her nose firmly stuck in what, judging by its spotty, oxidized pages, might have been a first edition of Pride and Prejudice. It seemed unlikely, though. Whole libraries had been turned in for salvage during the war, and nowadays there wasn't much left for the jumble sales. Whatever books remained unsold at the end of the summer season would, on Guy Fawkes Night, be carted from the basement of the parish hall, heaped up on the village green, and put to the torch. I tipped my head sideways and took a quick squint at the stack of books Daffy had already set aside. On Sledge and Horseback to Outcast Siberian Lepers, Pliny's Natural History, The Martyrdom of Man, and the first two volumes of the Memoirs of Jacques Casanova, the most awful piffle. Except perhaps for Pliny, who had written some ripping stuff about poisons. I walked slowly along the table, running a finger across the books, all of them arranged with their spines upwards. Ethel M. Dell, E. M. Delafield, Warwick Deeping. I had noticed on another occasion that most of the great poisoners in history had names beginning with the letter C, and now here were all of these authors beginning with a D. Was I onto something? Some secret of the universe? I squeezed my eyes shut and concentrated. Dickens, Doyle, Dumas, Dostoevsky. I had seen all of them at one time or another, clutched in Daffy's hands. Daffy herself was planning to become a novelist when she was older. With a name like Daphne Deluce, she couldn't fail if she tried. "Daff," I said, "you'll never guess." "Quiet," she snapped. "I've told you not to speak to me when I'm reading." My sister could be a most unpleasant porpoise when she felt like it. It had not always been this way. When I was younger, for instance, and Father had recruited Daffy to hear my bedtime prayers, she had taught me to recite them in Pig Latin, and we had rolled among the down-filled pillows, laughing until we nearly split. Od gay, esplay, arthur fay, ely fay, and isis may, ullet may, and ogaday ute. But over the years, something had changed between my sisters and me. A little hurt, I reached for a volume that lay on top of the others. A Looking Glass for London and England. It was a book, I thought, that would appeal to Feely, since she was mad about mirrors. Perhaps I would purchase it myself and store it away against the unlikely day when I might feel like giving her a gift. Or a peace offering. Stranger things had happened. Riffling through its pages, I saw at once that it was not a novel, but a play, full of characters' names and what each of them said. Someone named Adam was talking to a clown. "A cup of ale without a wench, why, alas, 'tis like an egg without salt, or a red herring without mustard." What a perfect motto for a certain someone, I thought, glancing across to where Ned was now grazing away at my sister's neck as she pretended not to notice. On more than one occasion, I'd seen Ned sitting at his chores in the courtyard of the 13 Drakes with a tankard of ale, and sometimes Mary Stoker, the landlord's daughter, at his elbow. I realized with an unexpected shock that without either ale or a female within easy reach, Ned was somehow incomplete. Why hadn't I noticed that before? Perhaps, like Dr. Watson on the wireless in A Scandal in Bohemia, there are times that I see, but do not observe. This was something I needed to think about. "Your handiwork, I suppose," Daffy said suddenly, putting down a book and picking up another. She gestured towards the small knot of villagers who stood gawking at the smoking ruins of the gypsy's tent.
"It has Flavia Deluce written all over it."
"Sucks to you," I said. "I was going to help carry your stupid books home, but now you can jolly well lug them yourself."
Oh, do stop it, she said, clutching at my sleeve. Please desist. My heartstrings are playing Mozart's Requiem, and a fugitive tear is making its way to my right eye, even as we speak.
I wandered away with a careless whistle. I'd deal with her insolence later.
Ow! Leave off, Brookie! You're hurting me!
The whining voice was coming from somewhere behind the Shove Halfpenny booth, and when I recognized it as belonging to Colin Prout, I stopped to listen. By flattening myself against the stone wall of the church and keeping well back behind the canvas that draped the raffle booth, I could eavesdrop in safety. Even better, I was pleased to find that I had an unexpectedly clear view of Colin through the gaps in the booth's raw lumber. He was dancing at the end of Brookie Harewood's arm like a great spectacled fish, his thick eyeglasses knocked askew, his dirty blonde hair a hayrick, his large, damp mouth hanging open, gasping for air.
Leave off! I didn't do nothing!
With his other hand, Brookie took hold of the seat of Colin's baggy trousers and swiveled him round to face the smoking remains of the gypsy's tent.
Who did that then, eh? He demanded, shaking the boy to accentuate his words. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Where there's fire, there's matches. And where there's matches, there's Colin Prout.
Here,
Colin said, trying to ram a hand into his pocket.
Count 'em. You just count 'em, Brookie. Same number as I had yesterday. 3. I ain't used a 1.
As Brookie released his grip, Colin fell to the ground, rolled over on his elbows, dug into his trouser pocket, and produced a box of wooden matches, which he waved at his tormentor. Brookie raised his head and sniffed the air as if for guidance. His greasy cap and India rubber boots, his long moleskin coat and, in spite of the hot summer weather, a woolen scarf that clung like a scarlet serpent to his bulldog neck, made him look like a rat catcher out of Dickens. Before I could even wonder what to do, Colin had scrambled to his feet and the two of them had ambled away across the churchyard, Colin dusting himself off and shrugging elaborately, as though he didn't care. I suppose I should have stepped out from behind the booth, admitted I was responsible for the fire, and demanded that Brookie release the boy. If he refused, I could easily have run for the vicar or called for any one of the other able-bodied men who were within earshot. But I didn't. And the simple reason, I realized with a little chill, was this. I was afraid of Brookie Harewood. Brookie was Bishop Lacey's riffraff.
Brookie Harewood, Feely had sniffed, the day Mrs. Mullet suggested that Brookie be hired to help Dogger with weeding the garden and trimming the hedges at Buckshaw.
But he's a remittance man, isn't he? Our lives wouldn't be worth tuppence with him hanging about the place.
What's a remittance man? I asked when Feely had flounced from the kitchen.
I don't know, love, I'm sure, Mrs. M had replied. His mother's that lady as paints over in Malden Fenwick.
Paints? I had asked. Houses?
Houses? Bless you, no. It's pictures she paints. The gentry on horseback and that. Perhaps she'll even paint you some day in your turn. You and Miss Ophelia, Miss Daphne.
At which I had let out a snort and dashed from the room. If I were to be painted in oils, shellacked and framed, I would be posed in my chemical laboratory and nowhere else. Hemmed in by beakers, bell jars and Erlenmeyer flasks, I would be glancing up impatiently from my microscope in much the same way as my late great-uncle Tarquin de Luce is doing in his portrait, which still hangs in the picture gallery at Buckshaw. Like Uncle Tar, I would be visibly annoyed. No horses and gentry for me, thank you very much. A light pall of smoke still hung over the churchyard. Now that most of the onlookers had wandered off, the charred and smouldering remains of the gypsy's tent were clearly visible beside the path. But it wasn't so much the scorched circle in the grass that interested me
as what had been hidden behind it. A brightly painted gypsy caravan. It was butter yellow with crimson shutters and its lathwork sides, which sloped gently outwards beneath a rounded roof, gave it the look of a loaf of bread that has puffed out beyond the rim of the baking pan. From its spindly yellow wheels to its crooked tin chimney, and from its arched cathedral windows to the intricately carved wooden brackets on each side of the door, it was something that might have come rumbling out of a dream. As if to perfect the scene, an ancient sway-backed horse was grazing in a picturesque manner among the leaning gravestones at the far corner of the churchyard. It was a Romany cob. I recognized it at once from photographs I had seen in country life. With its feathered feet and tail, and a long mane that overhung its face, from beneath which it peered coyly out like Veronica Lake, the cob looked like a cross between a Clydesdale and a unicorn.
"Flavia, dear," said a voice behind me. It was Denwin Richardson, the vicar of St. Tancred's. "Dr. Darby would be most obliged if you run in and fetch a fresh pitcher of lemonade from the ladies in the kitchen." My ruffled glance must have made him feel guilty. Why is it that 11-year-old girls are always treated as servants? I'd go for it myself, you see, but the good doctor feels that the poor lady may well be put off by my clerical collar and so forth, and, well,
happy too, Vicar, I said cheerily, and I meant it. Being the lemonade bearer would give me access to the St. John's ambulance tent. Before you could say snap, I had loped into the parish hall kitchen. Excuse me, medical emergency, made off with a frosty jug of iced lemonade, and was now in the dim light of the first aid tent, pouring the stuff into a cracked tumbler. "I hope you're all right," I said, handing it to the gypsy. "Sorry about the tent. I'll pay for it, of course."
Dr. Darby said. "No need. She's already explained that it was an accident."
The woman's awful red-rimmed eyes watched me warily as she drank.
"Dr. Darby," the vicar said, sticking his head through the flaps of the tent like a turtle, so that his dog collar wouldn't show. "If you can spare a moment, it's Mrs. Peasley at the Skittles pitch. She's come all over queer, she says."
The doctor said, snapping shut his black bag.
"What you need, my old gal," he said to the gypsy, "is a good rest." And to me, "Stay with her, I shan't be long." "Never rains," he remarked to no one in particular on his way out.
For the longest time I stood awkwardly staring at my feet, trying to think of something to say. I dared not look the gypsy in the eye. "I'll pay for the tent," I repeated, "even though it was an accident." That set her off coughing again, and it was evident, even to me, that the fire had taken its toll on her already shaky lungs. I waited, helpless, for the gasping to subside. When at last it did, there was another long, unnerving silence.
"The woman," the gypsy said at last, "the woman on the mountain. Who was she?"
"She was my mother," I said. "Her name was Harriet Deluce."
"The mountain?"
"Somewhere in Tibet, I think. She died there 10 years ago. We don't often speak of it at Buckshaw."
"Buckshaw means nothing to me."
"It's where I live, south of the village," I said with a vague wave of my hand.
"Ah,"
she said, fixing me with a piercing look.
"The big house, two wings folded back."
"Yes, that's it," I said, "not far from where the river loops round."
"Yes," the woman said, "I've stopped there. Never knew what the place was called."
"Stopped there? I could hardly believe it."
"The lady let my rom and me camp in a grove by the river. He needed to rest."
"I know the spot," I said. "It's called the Pearlings, all elder bushes and
berries,"
she added. "But wait," I said, "the lady, There's been no lady at Buckshaw since Harriet died. The gypsy went on as though I'd said nothing.
A beautiful lady she was too. Bit like you, she added, peering at me closely. Now that I see you in the light.
But then her face darkened. Was it my imagination, or was her voice growing stronger as she spoke?
Then we got turned out, she said angrily. They said we wasn't wanted there no more. 'Twas the summer Johnny Farr died.
Johnny Farr?
My rum. Me husband died in the middle of a dusty road, clutching at his chest like and cursing the gaho, the Englishman that had turned us out.
And who is that? I asked, already fearing the answer.
Never asked his name, straight as a ramrod on two sticks. The devil.
Father, I was sure of it. It was Father who, after Harriet's death, had run the gypsies off his estate. And Johnny Farr, your husband, he died because of it, you say? The gypsy nodded, and I could see by the sadness in her eyes that it was true. Because he needed to rest.
Needed to rest, she repeated in a whisper. And so do I.
And that was when it came to me. Before I could change my mind, I had blurted out the words. You can come back to Buckshaw, stay as long as you like. It will be all right, I promise. Even as I said it, I knew that there would be a great flaming row with Father, but somehow that didn't matter. Harriet had once given these people refuge, and my blood would hardly allow me to do otherwise. "We'll park your caravan at the pilings," I said, "in the bushes. No one even needs to know you're there." Her black eyes scanned my face, darting quickly from side to side. I held out my hand to her for encouragement.
Go on, old girl. Take her up on it. Spotteress would do you a world of good.
It was Dr. Darby who had slipped quietly back into the tent. He shot me an eighth of a wink. The doctor was one of Father's oldest friends, and I knew that he, too, could already foresee the coming battle. He had viewed the field and weighed the risks even before he spoke. I wanted to hug him. He placed his black bag on the table, rummaged in its depths, and extracted a corked bottle.
"Take as required for cough," he said, handing it to the gypsy.
She stared at it dubiously.
"Go on," he urged.
"Take it. It's wicked bad luck to refuse a licensed practitioner, you know."
"I'll help with the horse," he volunteered. "Used to have one myself."
Now he was putting on the old country doctor routine, and I knew that, medically speaking, we were in the clear. Knots of people stared as the doctor shepherded us towards the caravan. In no time at all, he had the gypsy's horse in harness, and the two of us settled on the wooden ledge that served as both doorstep and driving seat. The old woman made a clucking noise, and the villagers gave way on both sides as the caravan jerked into motion and began to rumble slowly along the churchyard path. From my high vantage point, I looked down into the many upturned faces, but Feely's and Daffy's were not among them. Good, I thought. They were most likely in one of the stalls stuffing their stupid faces with scones and clotted cream. Chapter 2. We lumbered through the high street, the sound of the horses' hooves echoing loudly on the cobbles. "What's his name?" I asked, pointing at the ancient animal.
"Gray."
"Gray?"
"Gray. Horse, in the Romany tongue."
I tucked that odd bit of knowledge away for future use, looking forward to the time when I would be able to trot it out in front of my know-it-all sister, Daffy. Of course she would pretend that she knew it all along. It must have been the loud clatter of our passage that brought Miss Cool, the village postmistress, scurrying to the front of her confectionery shop. When she spotted me seated beside the gypsy, her eyes widened and her hand flew to her mouth. In spite of the heavy plate glass windows of the shop and the street between us, I could almost hear her gasp. The sight of Colonel Haviland de Luce's youngest daughter being carried off in a gypsy caravan, no matter how gaily it was painted, must have been a terrible shock. I waved my hand like a frantic dust mop, fingers spread ludicrously wide apart, as if to say, "What jolly fun!" What I wanted to do, actually, was to leap to my feet, strike a pose, and burst into one of those yo-ho for the open road songs they always play in the cinema musicals. But I stifled the urge and settled for a ghastly grin and an extra twiddle of the fingers. News of my abduction would soon be flying everywhere, like a bird loose in a cathedral. Villages were like that, and Bishop's Lacey was no exception. "We all lives in the same shoe," Mrs. Mullet was fond of saying. "Just like old Mother Hubbard." A harsh cough brought me back to reality. The gypsy woman was now bent over double, hugging her ribs. I took the reins from her hands. "Did you take the medicine the doctor gave you?" I asked. She shook her head from side to side, and her eyes were like two red coals. The sooner I could get this wagon to the Parlings and the woman tucked into her own bed, the better it would be. Now we were passing the 13 Drakes in Cow Lane. A little farther east, the road turned south towards Doddingsley. We were still a long way from Buckshaw and the Parlings. Just beyond the last row of cottages, a narrow lane known to locals as the Gully angled off to the right. A sunken stony cutting that skirted the west slope of Gouger Hill and cut more or less directly cross-country to the southeast corner of Buckshaw and the Parlings. Almost without thinking, I hauled on the reins and turned Gry's head towards the narrow lane. After a relatively smooth first quarter mile, the caravan was now lurching alarmingly. As we went on, bumping over sharp stones, the track became more narrow and rutted. High banks pressed in on either side, so steeply mounded with tangled outcroppings of ancient tree roots that the caravan, no matter how much it teetered, could not possibly have overturned. Just ahead, like the neck of a great green swan, the mossy branch of an ancient beech tree bent down in a huge arc across the road. There was scarcely enough space to pass beneath it. "Robber's Roost," I volunteered. "It's where the highwaymen used to hold up the mail coaches." There was no response from the gypsy. She seemed uninterested. To me, Robber's Roost was a fascinating bit of local lore. In the 18th century, the gully had been the only road between Doddingsley and Bishop's Lacey. Choked with snow in the winter, flooded by icy runoffs in spring and fall, it had gained the reputation, which it still maintained after 200 years, of being rather an unsavoury, if not downright dangerous, place to hang about. "Haunted by history," Daffy had once told me, as she was inking it onto a map she was drawing of Buckshaw and environs. With that sort of recommendation, the gully should have been one of my favourite spots in all of Bishop's Lacey. But it was not. Only once had I ventured nearly its whole length on Gladys, my trusty bicycle, before a peculiar and unsettling feeling at the nape of my neck had made me turn back. It had been a dark day of high gusty winds, cold showers, and low scudding clouds, the kind of day. The gypsy snatched the reins from my hands, gave them a sharp tug. "Hretch," she said gruffly, and pulled the horse up short. High on the mossy branch, a child was perched, its thumb jammed firmly into its mouth. I could tell by its red hair it was one of the bulls. The gypsy woman made the sign of the cross and muttered something that sounded like Hilda Muir.
"Draw,"
she added, flicking the reins. "Ja!" And Gride jerked the caravan back into motion. As we moved slowly under the branch, the child let down its legs and began pounding with its heels on the caravan's roof, creating a horrid hollow drumming noise behind us. If I'd obeyed my instincts, I'd have climbed up and at the very least given the brat a jolly good tongue-lashing. But one look at the gypsy taught me that there were times to say nothing. Rough brambles snatched at the caravan as it jolted and lurched from side to side in the lane, but the gypsy seemed not to notice. She was hunched over the reins, her watery eyes fixed firmly on some far-off horizon, as if only her shell were in this century, the rest of her escaped to a place far away in some dim and misty land. The track broadened a little, and a moment later we were moving slowly past a decrepit picket fence. Behind the fence were a tumbled-down house that seemed to be hammered together from cast-off doors and battered shutters, and a sandy garden littered with trash, which included a derelict cooker, a deep, old-fashioned pram with two of its wheels missing, a number of fossilized motor cars, and, strewn everywhere, hordes of empty tins. Clustered here and there around the property stood sagging outbuildings, little more than makeshift lean-tos thrown together with rotten mossy boards and a handful of nails. Over it all, arising from a number of smoking rubbish heaps, hung a pall of grey, acrid smoke, which made the place seem like some hellish inferno from the plates of a Victorian illustrated Bible. Sitting in a washtub in the middle of the muddy yard was a small child, which jerked its thumb from its mouth the instant it saw us and broke into a loud and prolonged wailing. Everything seemed to be coated with rust. Even the child's red hair added to the impression that we had strayed into a strange, decaying land where oxidation was king. Oxidation, I never tire of reminding myself, is what happens when oxygen attacks. It was nibbling away at my own skin at this very moment and at the skin of the gypsy seated beside me, although it was easy to see that she was much farther gone than I was. From my own early chemical experiments in the laboratory at Buckshaw, I had verified that in some cases, such as when iron is combusted in an atmosphere of pure oxygen, oxidation is a wolf that tears hungrily at its food, so hungrily, in fact, that the iron bursts into flames. What we call fire is really no more than our old friend oxidation working at fever pitch. But when oxidation nibbles more slowly, more delicately, like a tortoise, at the world around us, without a flame, we call it rust, and we sometimes scarcely notice as it goes about its business, consuming everything from hairpins to whole civilizations. I have sometimes thought that if we could stop oxidation, we could stop time, and perhaps be able to... My pleasant thoughts were interrupted by an ear-piercing shriek. "Gypsy! Gypsy!" A large red-headed woman in a sweat-stained cotton house dress came windmilling out of the house and across the yard towards us. The sleeves of her cardigan were rolled up above her raw-boned elbows as if for battle.
"Gypsy! Gypsy! Clear off!" she shouted, her face as red as her hair. "Tom, get out here! That gypsy's at the gate!"
Everyone in Bishop's Lacey knew perfectly well that Tom Bull had cleared off ages ago and that he would not likely be back. The woman was bluffing.
"'Twas you who stole my baby, and don't tell me you didn't. I seen you hanging round here that day, and I'll stand up in any court of law and say so."
The disappearance of the Bull's baby girl several years earlier had been a seven-day wonder, but the unsolved case had gradually crept to the back pages of the newspapers, then faded from memory.
I glanced at the gypsy to see how she was bearing up under the ravings of her howling accuser. She sat motionless on the driving ledge, staring straight ahead, numb to the world. It was a response that seemed to spur the other woman to an even greater frenzy.
"Tom, get yourself out here and bring the axe," the woman screeched.
Until then, she had seemed hardly to notice me, but now my gaze had become suddenly entangled with hers, and the effect was dramatic.
"I know you," she shouted. "You're one of them Deluce girls from over at Buckshaw, ain't you? I recognise them cold blue eyes anywhere."
Cold blue eyes? Now here was something worth thinking about. Although I had often been frozen in my tracks by Father's icy stare, I had never for an instant thought of possessing such a deadly weapon myself. I realised, of course, that we were in a dangerous situation, the sort of predicament that can turn nasty in a flash. It was obvious that the gypsy woman was beyond counting upon. For all practical purposes, I was on my own.
"I'm afraid you're mistaken," I said, lifting my chin and narrowing my eyes to achieve the greatest effect. "My name is Margaret Vole, and this is my great-aunt Gilda Dickinson. Perhaps you've seen her in the cinema. The Scarlet Cottage, Queen of the Moon. But, of course, how foolish of me. You wouldn't recognise her in this gypsy costume, would you? Or in her heavy makeup? I'm sorry. I'm afraid I didn't catch your name, Miss..."
"Bull," the woman stammered, slightly taken aback.
"Mrs. Bull."
She stared at us in utter astonishment, as if she couldn't believe her eyes.
"Lovely to meet you, Mrs. Bull," I said.
"I wonder if you might offer us assistance. We're thoroughly lost, you see. We were to have joined the Cine crew hours ago at Malden Fenwick. We're both of us quite hopeless when it comes to directions, aren't we, Aunt Gilda?"
There was no response from the gypsy.
The red-headed woman had already begun to poke damp strands of hair back into position.
"Damn fools, whoever you are," she said, pointing. "There's no turning round hereabouts. Lane's too narrow. Straight on to Doddingsley you'll have to go, then back by way of Tench."
"Thanks awfully," I said in my best village twit voice, taking the reins from the gypsy and giving them a flick.
"Yah,"
I cried, and Gry began to move at once. We had gone about a quarter of a mile when suddenly the gypsy spoke.
"You lie like one of us," she said.
It was hardly the sort of remark I should have expected. She must have seen the puzzled look on my face.
"You lie when you are attacked for nothing, for the colour of your eyes."
"Yes," I said, "I suppose I do." I had never really thought of it in this way.
"So," she said, suddenly animated, as if the encounter with Mrs. Bull had warmed her blood. "You lie like us. You lie like a gypsy."
"Is that good?" I asked. "Or bad?"
Her answer was slow in coming.
"It means you will live a long life."
The corner of her mouth twitched, as if a smile was about to escape, but she quickly suppressed it.
"In spite of the broken star on my Mount of Luna?"
I couldn't resist asking. Her creaking laugh caught me by surprise.
"Mumble jumble, fortune teller's rubbish. You weren't taken in by it, were you?"
Her laughter set off another round of coughing, and I had to wait until she regained her breath.
"But the woman on the mountain, the woman who wants to come home from the cold."
"Look," the gypsy woman said wearily, as if she were unaccustomed to speaking.
"Your sisters put me up to it. They tipped me off about you and Harriet. Slipped me a couple of bob to scare the daylights out of you. No more to it than that."
I felt my blood freeze. It was as though the faucet that feeds my brain had suddenly switched from hot to cold. I stared at her.
"Sorry if I hurt you," she went on. "I never meant to."
"It makes no difference," I said with a mechanical shrug. But it did. My mind was reeling. "I'm sure I shall find a way of repaying them."
"Maybe I can help," she said. "Revenge is my specialty."
Was she pulling my leg? Hadn't the woman just admitted that she was a fraud? I looked deeply into her black eyes, searching for a sign.
"Don't stare at me like that. It makes me blood itch. I said I was sorry, didn't I? And I meant it."
"Did you?" I asked rather haughtily.
"Spare us the pout. There's enough lip in the world without you adding to it."
She was right. In spite of my turning them down, the corners of my mouth flickered, then began to rise. I laughed and the gypsy laughed with me.
"You put me in mind to that creature that was in the tent just before you, regular thundercloud. Told her there was something buried in her past. Told her it wanted digging out, wanted setting right. She went white as the garden gate."
"Why, what did you see?" I asked.
"Money," she said with a laughing snort. "Same as I always see. Couple of quid if I played my cards right."
"And did you?"
"Pfft, a blooming shilling she left me, not a penny more. Like I said, she went all goosey when I told her that. Scampered out of my pitch as if she'd sat on a thistle."
We rode along in silence for a while, and I realised that we had almost reached the Parlings. To me, the Parlings was like some lost and forgotten corner of paradise. At the southeast angle of the Buckshaw estate, beneath a spreading tent of green and leafy branches, the river, as though twirling in its skirts, swept round to the west in a gentle bend, creating a quiet glade that was almost an island. Here, the east bank was somewhat higher than the west bank more marshy than the east. If you knew precisely where to look among the trees, you could still spot the pretty arches of the little stone bridge, which dated from the time of the original Buckshaw, an Elizabethan manor house that had been put to the torch in the 1600s by irate villagers who made the wrong assumptions about our family's religious allegiances. I turned to the gypsy, eager to share my love of the place, but she seemed to have fallen asleep. I watched her eyelids carefully to see if she was shamming, but there wasn't so much as a flicker. Slumped against the frame of the caravan, she gave off the occasional wheeze so that I knew she was still breathing. In rather an odd way, I found that I resented her easy slumber. I was simply itching to reel off for her, like a tour guide, some of the more fascinating bits of Buckshaw's history. But for now, I should have to keep them to myself. The Parlings, as we called it, had been one of the haunts, in his latter days, of Nicodemus Flitch, a former tailor who, in the 17th century, had founded the Hobblers, a religious sect named for the peculiar shackled gait they adopted as they paced out their prayers. The Hobblers' beliefs seemed to be based largely on such novel ideas as that heaven was handily located 6 miles above the earth's surface, and that Nicodemus Flitch had been appointed personally by God as his mouthpiece and, as such, was licensed to curse souls to eternity whenever he felt like it. Taffy had told me that once, when Flitch was preaching at the Parlings, he had called down God's wrath upon the head of a heckler who fell dead on the spot, and that if I didn't fork over the tin of licorice all sorts that Aunt Felicity had sent me for my birthday, she would bring the same curse crashing down upon my head. "And don't think I can't," she had added, ominously, tapping a forefinger on the book that she'd been reading. "The instructions are right here on this page."
The heckler's death was a coincidence, I had told her, and most likely due to a stroke or a heart attack. He would likely have died anyway, even if he'd decided to stay home in bed on that particular day.
Don't bet on it, Daffy had grumbled.
In his later years, Flitch, driven from London in disgrace and steadily losing ground to the more exciting religious sects, such as the Ranters, the Shakers, the Quakers, the Diggers, the Levellers, the Sliders, the Swaddlers, the Tumblers, the Dunkers, the Tunkers, and yes, even the Incorrupticolians, had made his way to Bishop's Lacey, where at this very bend in the river, he had begun baptizing converts to his weird faith. Mrs. Mullet, after glancing over each of her shoulders and dropping her voice to a furtive whisper, had once told me that Nicodemus Flitch's strange brand of religion was still said to be practiced in the village, although nowadays strictly behind closed doors and drawn curtains.
They dips their babies by the eels, she said, wide-eyed. Like Killy's the eel in the river stinks, my friend Mrs. Waller says, her Bert told her. Don't you have nothing to do with them obblers? They'll have your blood for sausages.
I had grinned then, and I smiled now as I recalled her words. But I shivered too, as I thought of the Parlings and the shadows that swallowed its sunshine. My last visit to the glade had been in spring, when the clearing was carpeted with cowslips. Pagels, Mrs. Mallet called them, and primroses. Now the grove would be hidden by the tall elder bushes that grew along the river's bank. It was too late in the season to see, and to inhale the delicious scent of, the elder flowers. Their white blossoms, like a horde of Japanese parasols, would have turned brown and vanished with the rains of June. Perhaps more cheerful was the thought that the purplish-black elderberries, which took their place, would soon be hanging in perfectly arranged clusters, like a picture gallery of dark bruises. It was at the Parlings, in the days of the early numbered Georges, that the River Effin had been diverted temporarily to form the ornamental lake and feed the fountains whose remnants dotted the lawns and terraces at Buckshaw. At the time of its construction, this marvel of subterranean hydraulic engineering had caused no end of hard feelings between my family and the local landowners, so that one of my ancestors, Lucius Deluce, had subsequently become known as Leaking Deluce to half the countryside. In his portrait, which still hangs in our picture gallery at Buckshaw, he seems rather bored, overlooking the northwest corner of his lake, with its folly, its fountains, and the now long-gone Grecian temple. Lucius is resting the bony knuckles of one hand on a table, upon which are laid out a compass, a pocket watch, an egg, and a piece of gadgetry meant for surveyors called a theodolite. In a wooden cage is a canary with its beak open. It is either singing or crying for help. My cheerful musings were interrupted by a barking cough.
"Pull up," the gypsy said, snatching the reins from my hands.
Her brief nap must have done her some good, I thought. In spite of the cough, there was now more colour in her dusky cheeks, and her eyes seemed to burn more brightly than ever. With a clucking noise to Gry, and a quick ease that showed her familiarity with the place, she steered the caravan off the narrow road, under a leafy overhang, and onto the little bridge. Moments later, we had come to a stop in the middle of the glade. The gypsy climbed heavily down from her seat and began unfastening Gry's harness. As she saw to her old horse, I took the opportunity to glory in my surroundings. Patches of poppies and nettles grew here and there, illuminated by the downward slanting bars of the afternoon sun. Never had the grass seemed so green. Gry had noticed it too, and was already grazing contentedly upon the long blades. The caravan gave a sudden lurch, and there was a sound as though someone had stumbled. I jumped down and raced round the other side. It was evident at once that I had misread the gypsy's condition.
She had crumbled to the ground and was hanging on for dear life to the spokes of one of the tall wooden wheels. As I reached her side, she began to cough again, more horribly than ever. "You're exhausted," I said. "You ought to be lying down." She mumbled something and closed her eyes. In a flash, I had climbed up onto the wagon shafts and opened the door. But whatever I had been expecting, it wasn't this. Inside, the caravan was a fairy tale on wheels. Although I had no time for more than a quick glance round, I noticed an exquisite cast-iron stove in the Queen Anne style, and above it, a rack of blue willow chinaware. Hot water and tea, I thought, essentials in all emergencies. Lace curtains hung at the windows to provide first aid bandages if needed, and a pair of silver paraffin lamps with red glass chimneys swung gently from their mounts for steady light, a bit of heat, and a flame for the sterilizing of needles. My training as a girl guide, however brief, had not been entirely in vain. At the rear, a pair of carved wooden panels stood half open, revealing a roomy bunk bed that occupied nearly the whole width of the caravan. Back outside, I helped the gypsy to her feet, throwing one of her arms across my shoulder. "I've folded the steps down," I told her. "I'll help you to your bed." Somehow, I managed to shepherd her to the front of the caravan where, by pushing and pulling, and by placing her hands upon the required holds, I was at last able to get her settled. During most of these operations, she seemed scarcely aware of her surroundings, or of me. But once tucked safely into her bunk, she appeared to revive somewhat. "I'm going for the doctor," I said. Since I'd left Gladys parked against the back of the parish hall at the fete, I realized I'd have to hoof it later from Buckshaw back into the village. "No, don't do that," she said, taking a firm grip on my hand. "Make a nice cup of tea and leave me be. A good sleep is all I need." She must have seen the skeptical look on my face. "Fetch the medicine," she said. "I'll have just a taste. The spoons with the tea things." First things first, I thought, locating the utensil among a clutter of battered silverware and pouring it full of the treacly-looking cough syrup. "Open up, little birdie," I said with a grin. It was the formula Mrs. Mullet used to humour me into swallowing those detestable tonics and oils with which Father insisted his daughters be dosed. With her eyes fixed firmly on mine, was it my imagination, or did they warm a little? The gypsy opened her mouth dutifully and allowed me to insert the brimming spoon. "Swallow, swallow, fly away," I said, pronouncing the closing words of the ritual and turning my attention to the charming little stove. I hated to admit my ignorance. I hadn't the faintest idea how to light the thing. You might as well ask me to stoke up the boilers on the Queen Elizabeth. "Not here," the gypsy said, spotting my hesitation. "Outside, make a fire." At the bottom of the steps, I paused for a quick look round the grove. Elder bushes, as I have said, were growing everywhere. I tugged at a couple of branches, trying to tear them loose, but it was not an easy task. "Too full of life," I thought, "too springy."